As we were talking about last week, we're dealing with some challenging questions that as Christians, we need to be able to at least have some understanding of and begin to think about how to answer these if they come up as we defend the faith. We've been talking about the son of perdition. We'll finish that up this evening. Get into the millennium kingdom and what is the dispensational view of that, and then what is the biblical view of that. Moving forward, we'll also look at what the end of time will actually look like. Beyond that, heaven and hell, and what does the Bible say about those, and how do I get prepared for the second coming and final judgment? So when we think about the end of time and all these kinds of questions come up in people's minds, people are trying to understand these things. Many people have many questions about them. And so we're looking to the Word of God to answer those things. Now, what we've been looking at last week, we were looking at different scriptures, Matthew 24, Jesus warning us that there were going to be those who came along to teach false doctrine about these things. He calls them other Christs are going to try to come up and try to claim to be something that they're not, that they are the Christ. And so he's warning about that. He says, watch for those things. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 18, John tells us that there were many antichrists that were coming. It's not just one we're looking for, but anyone who is in opposition to Christ is essentially an antichrist, right? Same thing in 1 John 4, 2. So we've looked at those questions and also in 2 John. We spent some time in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verses 1 through 12. Just real quickly, this is for those who didn't hear it last week. I'm going to go through this real quickly. The son of destruction or son of perdition in 2 Thessalonians 2. What do we know? Number one, we note the time frame is 51 to 52 AD. That's where we are. And then we see Paul's description there in chapter 2 of this man. Number one, he oppresses other idols, and calling him an idol, right? He's setting himself up to be a so-called god. He puts himself above all the others. He takes the seat of God in the temple. He's someone trying to elevate himself to that place of God. You remember the temple, that's where the presence of God was. Within the old covenant, there on the mercy seat, well, here's someone who's trying to elevate himself to deity. He proclaims himself as God. We also note that Paul says he was at work at the time he's writing. That's in 51 to 52 AD. His power, Paul also notes, comes from Satan. He's behind this, as he is behind all evil. And ultimately, he says this man will be killed by the Lord by the breath of the Lord's mouth. That's the description. Then we went through and just noted a couple of things. Paul identifies this man as someone already at work. We already noted that. That's 51 to 52. So he narrows down our time frame of who this could be. I believe the most reasonable answer for this, or at least it makes sense to me, is that he may be pointing to the Roman Emperor Nero. As you may remember, he did cause the early church a great deal of trouble. He really brought the vigor of the Roman people against the early church. Nero, just kind of pointing out some reasons why. Nero would come to power in 54, which is right around this time frame. He's already in the Roman government, right? He's going to rise to power. He elevated himself to the place of God, calling himself a god. That's what he did. He deified himself. He would later bring a terrible persecution on the church. By blaming the Christians for the fire that burned down Rome in AD 64. That's the one where popular I don't know if it's true or not, but it may just be a myth, but about Rome playing the fiddle while Rome, Nero playing the fiddle while Rome burned. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but of course that's the old kind of mythology about this guy. But he definitely was a persecutor of Christians. However, at the end of this, could this be someone else other than Nero? Absolutely. I don't think you can speak with any definitiveness on anybody on this. I think the only things you need that are important to note is Paul's explaining he's already at work. So he's not looking to someone way in the future, but it was something that had to do with the Christians in Thessalonica of that day. Because remember, this is a message to Thessalonians to encourage them, not some future generation. So do you have to agree with me on Nero? Absolutely not. I'm just making my best reasonable guess. But you could have a different opinion. Any questions about that before I move on? I know we talked about it last week. All right, Dwayne.
Well, I mean, I was just going to say that I think that you're right when you're talking about Nero. Because he was the Roman emperor, you were supposed to worship him like God. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't the only one. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the Roman emperors for the next couple of hundred years basically thought they were supposed to be worshipped as God. And to a lesser and greater extent, they persecuted the church. And some of them were, a couple of them were at least as bad as Nero.
There are a couple that are worse. And we'll talk about them in a minute.
So part of this son of perdition, or whatever the particular version is, could be the Roman emperor.
Just in general?
Not necessarily one Roman emperor, but that position, because all of them, when they became emperor, that they were supposed to be worshipped as God.
Many of them took that idea. That's definitely true. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about, I guess, the term. I'm using the ESV, and so it may be different in other Bibles, but in verse 7, it says, for the mystery of lawlessness that's referred to is already at work. What is being referred to by the mystery of lawlessness?
All right, so that to me is hard, at least from my understanding, it's hard to define exactly what he means. But lawlessness would be what? Sinfulness, right? That this man is already at work. My impression is what he's referring to, is this individual is already at work against the church.
Okay.
Anybody have a better explanation? You more than, go ahead. Yes, ma'am. And then I'll come over there, Roger. Yeah, we're coming to him. So there are a couple other guys, kind of going back to Dwayne's point. There's Caligula, which is terrible. But Domitia, and we'll talk about him in just a minute. He was probably, a lot of historians and scholars will tell you he was the worst. But yes, they were evil guys. There's no doubt about it. So hold on to that, and we'll come back to that in just a few minutes. Yeah, Roger.
I just looked it up because that didn't seem right. The fiddle was invented in the 16th century.
What?
The fiddle was invented in the 16th century.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, so yeah, that's just the myth, right? So, yes.
So Nero invented
it. Any other comments about this? All right, so anyway, I'm just saying we can't be dogmatic. I don't know of any way to be dogmatic about the exact person who it refers to. Like Dwayne said, maybe it's just a general idea here, maybe a specific person. I'm not going to be dogmatic one way or the other about it, in my understanding. All right, so there's that one. All right, the other text we were looking at is in Revelation 13. And this is, we talked about last week. Again, I'm going to go through some of this real quickly. I know we've already been through it, just for the sake of those who were not able to hear it last week. We're given the vision of by John of two beasts. You have the sea beast, you have the land beast. The sea beast We talked about has great governmental power. He has a blasphemous name. Blasphemous meaning what? What's blasphemy? I want to just throw that term out. Claiming to be God, right? It's speaking against God, right? What's that?
I was just saying direct opposition to God.
Yeah. So you're thinking about something that is like cursing God, all right? Blasphemy, claiming a power of God for yourself, or the place of God for yourself, is a form of blasphemy. All right. We also note his power, throne, authority came from Satan. A lot of similarities between this guy and 2 Thessalonians 2. It didn't look the same, though. At least we're not given a description, are we, in 2 Thessalonians. But this guy, he's an odd-shaped being. Of course, it's all symbolic. One of the things we did learn is that he had a mortal wound that was healed. And typically, a mortal wound is something that you die of, and yet this guy is still living. We're going to talk about what the possible meaning for that is. I think there is an explanation for it. He demands worship of himself, toward himself. You might think about in the book of Daniel with the king, right? King Nebuchadnezzar, right? And set himself up for people to worship him. Others have done that over time. He did. He speaks blasphemous words. His reign will be short. It's not forever, right? It's 42 months, which is a symbolic way of just talking about it's not forever, but he will have a little while of terror. And he makes war against the saints of God. That's kind of what we know about the sea beast. So let's go to the earth beast. Revelation 13, 11 through 18. You go back into the text there. What do we know about this guy? He looks a little different, doesn't he? We know that unlike the other one, you know, he's just simply described as a lamb, right? Or sheep, right? With two horns, which indicate he has power, but it's smaller, it's lesser than the first beast. He speaks the words of Satan, just like Satan was behind the sea beast. Satan is behind the earth beast as well, referred to as the dragon. We know from the text it says that Satan, his power and authority come from the sea beast. This is real important. Now, we said the sea beast was what? A governmental power. And then this governmental power is giving this other being power. He enforces worship of the sea beast upon the citizenry. He performs false signs. You might think about from the book of Exodus with the... I was just talking to Lisa about it. The Pharaoh's magicians, how they tried to perform some of God's things. They seemingly did for a couple of them, but then eventually it got to where they couldn't do it. He's performing false signs. He charges smiths with the construction of idols, images of the sea beast. You might think about in the book of Acts when it talks about the worship of Diane. Remember, that's what got Paul into trouble. As he converted people to Christianity, they stopped buying these little idols of Diane. And then the smiths got upset at Paul because Paul is taking all these people away and stealing all their business. Well, this earth beast is putting people in charge of creating idols of the sea beast. He marks those who... And I said this wrong. I meant to correct this. I'm sorry. Those who fall under the worship of the sea beast are marked. I said that wrong on the... So I got to correct that on the PowerPoint. So those who worship the sea beast take on what? The mark of a man. We call it 666, which again is symbolic language. It just simply refers to the mark of a man, to the name of a man. They bear that on their right hand and on their forehead. I'll refer you back to Sunday sermon for that, for deeper detail. And you also can contrast that with the very next verses, right? Go on into chapter 14, verse 1. You contrast the group who take on the number of the beast against those who what? Take on the name of God, that they wear the name of God on their hands and on their forehead. So you have two different groups contrasted here. And so those who fall underneath the earth beast enforcement, those who give in and worship the sea beast are marked by the sea beast. All right. Questions about any of that? All right. So what does all that mean? I think that's what we need to look at. Just real quickly, I won't go back to this verse. But these beasts are mentioned again in Revelation 19. That's where they're punished at the end of time and thrown into the lake of fire, where they'll be punished along with Satan. So that's their ultimate end. All right, so let's get into the question. Can we identify what Jesus is, or the vision is trying to show to John? Who is the earth beast in Revelation 13? I think the evidence here really points to one individual for this. Again, I won't be too dogmatic, but I think the evidence is even stronger in this one. Number one, it was an individual. It was individuals who were persecuting the church. Did I do these backwards? Oh, I didn't put that up there. Oh. Lost my thing. I don't know where it is. But anyway, the sea beast. I'll get to the earth beast in a second. So who is the sea beast? All right, so we think, number one, about when is John writing his letter? Around the mid to late, or sorry, the early 90s. So late 80s to early 90s. He's probably in that time frame. I think that's the date that matches the best to the writing. I know some people have an early date for Revelation, but I think the evidence really doesn't point that way. Maybe we'll do a study in Revelation. I'll explain why I think it's the late date is the more preferable one. I think it was probably written late 80s, early 90s. And so who was reigning in Rome at the time? As was mentioned earlier, there was a guy named Domitia. He reigned in Rome. Maybe I have this up there. I do have that. Okay. So at Rome, you have Domitian. Domitian reigned from 81 AD to 96 AD. He brought heavy, heavy persecution upon the church. Especially in the later half of his reign, from 89 to 96. Most historians that I have looked into believe he was the worst. The things he did to Christians was horrific. You think about some of the things he did. One of the things was he would take Christians and he would put them on poles and put fuel on them and light them up in his garden. He used them as lamps. They were used on the Appian Way. What he did with flaying Christians and using their skin for particular objects around his place. You think about what he did to them in the Colosseum. Right? He was awful. And his brutality was terrible. What's interesting about him is that it was during his reign that there developed a myth about him, and it was called I don't have it in front of me, but there was a myth, and I'll look up the name for you, but there was a myth about him Yeah. Yes, Roger.
Yeah, that was the slight clarification. It would have been the Circus Maximus, not the Colosseum.
Okay. Well, yeah.
It's the same place where they did like the races.
Yeah, so, but anyway, the point is he was brutal to Christians, right? But there rose a myth about him that he was, in essence, the, I don't know if reincarnated Nero is the right idea, or Nero reborn. So it goes back to, you remember what it said in describing the sea beast, that he had a wound, a mortal wound that had healed? There was a belief that Nero never really died, and that dementia is essentially Nero. And that was a myth popular in Rome at the time. And that Nero had come back to life. It's kind of like Elvis, right? Elvis never really died. He's still there. A little newer, right? You remember Tupac, right? And people say Tupac's still out there. Michael Jackson, right? There have been all these myths. Well, there was one about Nero, and that dementia was really Nero. And that fits really well with the text in Revelation 13, talking about the mortal wound that had healed. He really fit that. Dementia did establish himself as emperor. I mean, as more than emperor, as deity. On the coinage of the day, he referred to him as God, himself as God. He would sign his letters as Lord and God, setting himself up as a deity. Of course, that wasn't anything new to emperors in Rome. You go all the way back to Julius Caesar. You think about Nero, we talked about, thinking about Caligula, and others even afterwards would set themselves up, deify themselves. He was indeed power hungry to control the Senate and the people and the army. So he was very paranoid too. And so he developed a group of people called the Consilia. Consilia. This group of people were in charge of emperor worship. They would go out into the communities and towns on Rome and under the Roman Empire, and they would go and enforce emperor worship. They were the ones who were in charge of the idol making, of finding people and arresting people who refused to worship. And so you didn't want the Consilia to come to your town if you're a Christian, because you knew this was going to be a moment when you were probably going to be put in prison, or your property taken, or all of it, maybe even killed. I think the reasonable evidence really points to the sea beast in this text of being dementia, and the earth beast being the Consilia. They really fit those descriptions very well, and would have been appropriate from the time frame of John. I don't believe this is some future Antichrist that's going to arise. That doesn't fit. The best fit is someone of the day, and dementia really fits this very well as the Consilia. Any questions about that? It's a lot of information, I know. So some try to teach this as the rising of an Antichrist sometime in the future. I don't believe that fits at all here. And I believe the biblical evidence fits better with a man of the time frame John lived. All right. No questions? Everybody tired of this one? Let's move on. All right. So let's talk for a few minutes about the question about the millennium kingdom. Now, if you have your chart, I have these here. Somebody wants one. anybody else need one?
Yes, sir.
I have more of a comment, but if you'll notice, and I think I have it up on the board too. So if you look back at dispensationalism and kind of how it sets itself up, you remember again that they believe we're living in this time frame here. This is the church age. But eventually, sometime in the future, there'll be a rapture where the Christians, the faithful of that time will be resurrected in the rapture to be taken to heaven, where they'll spend 7 years during what they call the tribulation. We've kind of all dealt with all those already. But they believe that once that 7 years is over, Christ will return to establish his millennium or thousand-year kingdom here on earth. And I think, I won't label all dispensationalists this way, but I think most of them believe that this was the original plan of God, was to establish a millennium kingdom when Christ first came. But because of the Jews' rejection, God went to plan B, which was the church. That's kind of what undergirds some of the thought here. So let's go into the text and let's see where this is pulled from. All right, if you go to the book of Revelation, chapter 20, and if we read just a little bit here in the first part of that chapter, you notice what John sees. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, the ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and threw him into the pit and shut it and sealed it over him so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be released for a little while. Now, you come to that text, and on a cursory reading, does it fit with this idea of dispensationalism, with premillennialism? It kind of almost seems to fit, right? But can you see any problems with that view? Number one, when we think about numbers in the book of Revelation, numbers are never to be taken literally, but symbolically. 1,000 years is what? It's 10 times 100, right? And what's the number 10 represent? Completeness, perfection, right? It's those ideas. And so when you think about 1,000 as being a multiple of 10, a high multiple, right? You're thinking about a long period of time. Now, can we know exactly what he means by 1,000 years? No, but it is an extended amount of time. So just on the surface, the idea of a literal 1,000 years, you can't get that from Revelation because that's not the way the book is written. It's written in symbolic form. The other thing too, when it speaks about Satan being a dragon, is that literal? Again, it's figurative, right? He's trying to use figurative language. Do we really believe that God is going to send an angel to arrest Satan and throw him in a pit? That also doesn't hold water. Satan is a what? Spiritual being. He's not a physical being. He lives in a spirit plane, right? And so that doesn't quite fit. But what is the emphasis of the text? What can we take away from it?
That he's going to be bound.
He is going to be controlled in some way for an extended amount of time, right? So there is an extended amount of time that Satan's going to be bound for. When is that? Well, I think I have this here. I want to give you another sheet. I have another chart. Somebody pass this out for me.
Okay, yeah.
Do you want to pass this out? All right. I want you to notice some things here in chapter 20.
Oh, you'll give me.
It'd be good. I'm not sure that one. All right. So let's think about the text here. I'll give everybody a second to get these sheets. But the first section mentions some or notes some things that are not mentioned in the text that for a premillennialist you have to assume have to be there. But yet they're not. For this to fit, number one, Jerusalem. All right, so some of the things it doesn't mention is Jerusalem being in Palestine, the establishment of a kingdom on earth, the rebuilding of the temple, Christ setting foot on the earth. It doesn't mention the second coming of Christ. It doesn't mention a bodily resurrection on earth. It doesn't mention a reign on earth, the literal throne of David on the earth. Saints of the 20th or 21st century are not mentioned in this text. A literal throne of David on earth. Oh, sorry, I did that already. Specifically, how long Jesus reigns, or anything about reigning over people who are living and have not died. Do you see that anywhere in those verses? Do you even see the word kingdom in this text? It's just not there. You cannot read in between lines. The Bible actually, when we go to Thessalonians, tells us that Jesus is going, we are going to do what? Meet him in the clouds. There's not one verse in the text of all the New Testament ever mentions Jesus coming back to earth and putting a foot on earth. Impossibilities of premillennialism, things they say are disproven. They say Jesus is not reigning on his throne. Yet, let's just look at a couple of these. Go to Revelation chapter 3 and verse 21. In writing to the Laodicean church, you notice, the one who conquers, I will grant him to sit with me where? On my throne. As I also conquered and sat down with my Father on his throne. Now, premillennialists say he's not on his throne. Yet, when I read Revelation 3:21, it says just the opposite, doesn't it? Other verses, I'll let you go and look at verses 4 and 5. I'm sorry, chapters 4 and 5 of Revelation. Matthew 28:18, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Ephesians 1, 20 through 23, Jesus reigning over the church. And Acts 2, 30 through 36. Number two, they say the kingdom of Christ is not yet in existence. Well, let's notice just one couple chapters back, chapter 1, 4, and 6. John here introducing himself or himself in the letter. He says, John, to the seven churches that are in Asia, grace to you and peace from him who is and was and is to come, and from the seven spirits who are before his throne. And from Jesus Christ, the faithful witness, the firstborn of the dead, and the ruler of the kings on earth, to him who loves us and has freed us from our sins by his blood. And then verse 6, and made us what? And made us what? A kingdom. Priest to his God and Father, to him be glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. Again, the kingdom of Christ has been established. And this is just one passage. There's the other ones there. I'll refer you to, I go to Colossians 3. I was at Colossians 1, 13. What does the text tell us? That God has, he's taken us out of the domain of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of his dear son. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the kingdom is synonymous with the church. All right, so that's exactly right. So number three, they say the resurrection of the righteous before the wicked. However, we go to, we could go to either of those texts. Let's go to Revelation 20 and verse 5. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. All right, so he's referring to the resurrection at the end of time, that at the end of the 1,000 years, they'll be resurrected. If you go to John 5, well, here in this one, again, the ones that have been resurrected, he notes this, are those, he's talking about those who are reigning with him in his kingdom, but not all were raised at that time. Go to John 5. John 5 and verse 28. Here again, he says, do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all, you might want to underline that, when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out. How many?
All.
Those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. At the resurrection, who's coming out? All that he specifies, right? The good and the evil, right? There's not this split resurrection idea that is taught by some, but is a resurrection of all. They also claim Jesus is living and reigning on earth in person, that he will do that. John 4, just a chapter back from where we were in 21. If this is the one I want. Well, let's just read this. So John 4:21. Jesus said to the Samaritan woman, the question of worship has come up. He said, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain in Samaria nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. So it's not going to be in Samaria or Jerusalem. The idea is it's not going to be about where, right? But what does he say? Go to verse 22. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. And so the idea there is it's not about a place, but it is about how we're doing it, both in spirit and in truth, that his kingdom is not going to be an earthly thing, but what is going to occur is something that is spiritual. You think about John 18:36. What does Jesus tell Pilate when Pilate says, are you a king? Do you remember how it goes? He says, for rightly you say that I'm a king. For this purpose I was born. But what? But my kingdom is not of this world. And so clearly telling Pilate that's just not the case. Saints reigning with Christ physical on earth. Again, we've hit that already, but the ideal of the kingdom is not an earthly thing. And then the ideal of a second chance for the living at Christ's return. Remember, after the 7 years tribulation, they'll be given a second chance, but that's not taught there. If you go to Matthew 25, the ideal taught there is we have one chance, and that's this life that we're in right now. Hebrews 9:27, for Christ died once. For unto all men is to die once, and then after that, the judgment. Go ahead, Dwayne.
I just had a comment about all this. The thing that gets me the most is how premillennialists seem to try to give people the impression that somehow God made a mistake the first time that Jesus came. The Jews rejected him. He was crucified like, oh, gee, I needed to back up and see if we could redo this. Well, if he made a mistake, then he's not God.
Amen.
Absolutely.
And yet they get people to believe this all over the place.
And you also see that there's a lot of assumptions that are made in this text. Again, in Revelation 20, there's no mention of a kingdom. So what? There's just simply a mention of Satan being bound for a period of time. And we'll talk next week about that. But what does he mean? What is intended by the text here? I know it's a lot of information I've kind of thrown at you. You may think about questions over the week, and we can deal with some of those next week. Thank you.